Welcome back to the Vatican Briefing, National Catholic Reporter's podcast covering Pope Francis and the big decisions facing the global Catholic Church. I'm Joshua McElwee, the reporter's news editor.
And hello, I'm Christopher White, the reporter's Vatican correspondent.
Later in this episode, we'll hear from Javier Martinez Brocal, a Spanish-language Vatican journalist who recently published a book-length interview with Pope Francis. Javier spoke with Chris about what it was like to go into the Vatican Santa Marta Hotel to interview the Pope. Javier also spoke about how he got Francis to reveal behind-the-scenes details from the 2013 conclave that elected him as Bishop of Rome. Stick around, it's really an interesting interview. But before that, Chris, it's nice to see you again. We haven't done one of these in person in a while.
Yes, hello, Josh. How are you?
So we're speaking today on Wednesday, April 10th. Just 2 days ago on Monday, the Vatican released a new document from the Vatican's Dicaster for the Doctrine of the Faith called Dignitas Infinita that really addresses a number of percolating, interesting moral issues. You want to talk about it a bit, Chris? What did the Vatican say? What was this document about?
Sure. So this is a document that was about 5 years in the making that really touched on, as you said, just a range of issues, Josh. And I'd say a few things about this document. One, it's sort of an attempt to look at the concept of human dignity and its sort of philosophical, historical, theological underpinnings. But it quickly pivots to concrete issues, talking about a range of issues from war, peace, migration, human trafficking, to also abortion, the death penalty, euthanasia, and sort of entering into the fray and sort of are these issues that have gotten a lot of attention in this document, such as surrogacy, gender theory, gender-affirming surgery. And I think that's what's dominated the discussion in recent days. What's most interesting about this document is that on one hand, it is a document that is meant to, in a sense, talk about the range of issues that human dignity and for threats to human dignity confront. One of the things we've seen in this document is an attempt to sort of pivot away from just bioethical concerns, such as abortion or euthanasia, and say you have to talk about these issues, or to use the language of Laudato Si, to show that everything is connected. On the other hand, rather, the issue talks about issues such as, you know, gender theory and gender-affirming surgery and kind of gets a lot of attention for the way it addresses the pelvic issues. I think you've got, you know, for some people, a bit of whiplash in how they have received the document.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, Chris. And you did a fine job on Monday for a National Catholic Reporter at NCR Online, kind of outlining the different points of the document and making a very thorough and layered analysis of what it says, what it doesn't say, and kind of where it comes from. I wonder, maybe we should talk a bit about kind of some of the more controversial things. So for one instance, example, the document makes clear again that Catholic teaching would not support someone seeking gender-affirming surgery. It also makes clear the Vatican's more vocal opposition lately to the issue of child surrogacy or couples who might ask a third party, another woman, to carry a child to term for them. And it's quite clear that on those issues, the Vatican is saying things that are a bit controversial, things that are attracting a bit of headlines, but also things that aren't exactly new. They've been Catholic teaching for quite a while. And I wonder how you see that balance in terms of what the document says and the fact that it's kind of restating what has already been known.
Yeah, I think for the most part, if you read this, you know, 12,000-word document, it's about 20 pages. You know, most readers that have some familiarity with Catholic, you know, teaching on, you know, social and moral issues will say, well, this isn't anything new here. It doesn't really pioneer too much new territory. But I think it's a matter of emphasis. I mean, you mentioned the issue of surrogacy. Last January, during the Pope's annual sort of State of the World address, this is when he addresses all the ambassadors from all over the globe that are accredited to the Holy See, and talks about a number of conflicts around the world, he kind of surprised us by also bringing up this issue, and he called specifically for a global ban to the practice of surrogacy, and at the time called it deplorable. This is, again, it's nothing new. The Church has long opposed surrogacy ever since it, you know, sort of became a practice. But I think we've seen a new focus. And you yourself, Josh, wrote about this recently at the UN. We saw the Holy See's mission to the UN address this just last month.
Yeah, I was there at the UN for the meetings of the Commission on the Status of Women to cover a couple of issues and attended a session hosted by the Vatican's permanent delegate to the UN, Archbishop Gabriele Caccia. And it seems clear that the Vatican has maybe identified this as an issue where they could create allies or coalitions on people concerned about justice issues that maybe wouldn't normally ally with them, especially people concerned with the possible global implications of how surrogates are contracted to help couples, whether there might be questions about, you know, basically paying for someone to have have a child, how that can be ethical or not. And it was quite interesting to see that. And it's quite interesting to see the Vatican push this forward after the Pope made that declaration last year, as you mentioned, Chris. Something I think we should talk about too is there was a five-year process of drafting for this document. As you noted in your piece for our newspaper, Cardinal Victor Fernandez at the press conference on Monday spoke about how this was originally started in 2019. It's gone through several drafts. And one thing I want to mention here is groups who support LGBTQ Catholics in the church, such as New Ways Ministry and Dignity USA. I think they made an interesting point in that there's been a five-year process for this document, but it doesn't seem as if there was a lot of consultation with the people who it addresses, such as trans Catholics, or perhaps even Catholics who would have had children via surrogacy. And I wonder if there's something there in terms of this document not really listening to those people and at least including some of their viewpoints.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things for context, most of our listeners will know who Cardinal Fernandez is. He's been a longtime ally, theological advisor to Pope Francis, played a sort of background role in drafting some of the Pope's early encyclicals. But about a year ago, Pope Francis named him as the head of the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. And he specifically tapped him with the intent that he make that office more dialogical in nature. And at the beginning of this text that came out on Monday, the cardinal dedicates about two pages to kind of give some background to the document. And one of the things he specifically says is that when in the earlier drafts, when he went to the Pope said, no, you have to expand this. Human dignity has to talk about all the issues confronting human dignity, not just the pelvic issue, as some might say, but you have to talk about war, peace, migration, human trafficking. So you do see, on one hand, this effort to expand the document to reflect the range of issues in Catholic social thought. On the other hand, there is this sort of, you know, as you mentioned, sort of puzzling aspect of it that it was a five-year consultation process where the listening seems to have perhaps been quite limited. And it came out at a time in which the global church is engaged in this multi-years-long synod process where listening is sort of the theme du jour. It's sort of what the Pope is trying to invite the whole church to do. And I think some Catholics in particular feel as if this document did not achieve that in its end product.
Yeah, maybe one more thing we should say about this, and then we can kind of move on to other subjects. But it's also interesting that this document comes from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, as you mentioned, now led by Cardinal Fernandez, who is really a key ally of Pope Francis, clearly someone who articulates Pope Francis's viewpoints. And it comes at a time when the Dicastery has also made other declarations that have been quite positive towards gay Catholics. Late last year, determining that priests could go ahead and offer blessings to people in same-sex marriages or same-sex couples, as well as to people who have been divorced and remarried, a huge step forward for the Catholic Church. Also making clear earlier in last year that people who are trans or who even have had gender-affirming surgery can be baptized, can serve as godparents in the church. So it's quite interesting that there's kind of a two-step going on here in terms of clarifying church teaching on certain areas, but also being very open and being very pastoral in other areas.
Yeah, I think we saw after the, you know, original decision in December that allowed for priests to provide, you know, blessings for, you know, same-sex couples, tremendous blowback, particularly in Eastern Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa. And in one of the interviews to that document, Cardinal Fernandez said, look, we are getting some blowback, but in a few months, we're going to have another document on human dignity. And I think that will satisfy the concerns of more sort of conservative-minded people who are struggling to accept our decision on gay blessings. And I think what we see here is this the real challenge and difficulty of trying to preserve unity in the Catholic Church, both to extend pastoral welcome, also sort of being anchored in, you know, Catholic doctrine, and the real tightrope act that Cardinal Fernandez, Pope Francis, and others are having to do here.
And one more thing, I keep saying that, but one more thing we should say is also Cardinal Fernandez was very clear at that press conference to say that the Vatican does not support the criminalization of homosexuality. They don't think it's something that should be criminalized. And that's also a very interesting point they continue to make about respect for individual persons and respect for people no matter their circumstance or kind of where they are in their lives. Chris, maybe we can talk about two more things quickly here before we get to your interview. The first is we just want to mark the passing of the late Detroit Auxiliary Bishop Thomas Gumbleton. He is someone who Chris and I have known, and we know that many people in the U.S. Catholic Church will know him well, an important figure in the life in the last few decades of the post-Vatican II American Catholic Church. And as we said in our obituary at ncronline.org, the longtime soul of the U.S. Catholic peace movement. Chris, you have a piece actually today as we speak on our website reporting on a letter that Pope Francis wrote to Bishop Gumbleton before his death. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure, Josh. I mean, the piece was sort of building on, leapfrogging from your fine obituary of Gumbleton. And one of the things in the aftermath of his death that sort of was revealed to us is that a few months ago in January, Pope Francis wrote to Bishop Gumbleton on the occasion of his 94th birthday, which turned out to be, of course, his last birthday. He just thanked him for his testimony and being a good shepherd. And, you know, those that were with Bishop Gumbleton when he received the letter talked about how shocked he was to receive the letter, how he had to read it multiple times and was convinced at first that it was a prank. And, you know, in the piece, we look at sort of the backstory of how the letter came to be. And it had the backing and support of Cardinal Tobin of Newark, New Jersey, who's, of course, a close ally of Pope Francis and who will be presiding over Gumbleton's funeral mass in the coming days here. But I think, as you mentioned moments ago in the obituary, Gumbleton was just an incredibly important figure in the life of the post-Vatican II Church, particularly in the pages of NCR. So I think his passing for many, many Catholics will be a moment of great sadness, but also a reflection of just sort of the changes that have taken place in the 60 years since he was made a bishop and since the council.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for doing that piece. And if you haven't seen it yet, you might want to go look. There's a wonderful photo that Chris was able to get from Gumbleton's family showing him reading that letter from Pope Francis in the last months of his life. And you get a sense of how important that was and what it must have meant to him and really what it means to the American Catholic Church and to American Catholics who find so much hope in Francis and had so much relationship with Bishop Gumbleton. Maybe we should pivot now just to talk about why we wanted to interview Javier this week. So Javier is a friend of both of ours, a fellow Vatican journalist we've known for years. It's quite interesting. There's been a slew of these papal interviews recently, including on major Italian TV programs. Francis is always quite media savvy, always quite ready to kind of take an interview, answer questions. But frankly, you know, he's very good at it. He's very able to repeat information we've heard 1,000 times. Many of you will heard him talk about a church that goes forth, or to condemn the throwaway culture, or to speak about the war in Gaza or Ukraine and to issue general condemnations of war or violence or other situations. But what I found interesting about Javier's book, Chris, was just that it contains some genuinely new information. And we should say it's titled in Spanish, El Sucesor, or The Successor, placing Francis in the context of his predecessor, the late Pope Benedict XVI. And I wonder kind of what you saw in the interview, Chris, and kind of what put us in mind to interview Javier this week.
Yeah, Josh, one of the things that this book has done really well is give us the backstory of not just one, but two conclaves. I mean, the Pope talks about his own experience in the 2005 conclave that elected Cardinal Ratzinger, who would become Pope Benedict XVI. As is widely known, Francis is a runner-up in that election, or a very popular candidate. And then he talks about the 2013 conclave in which he was elected Pope. He talks about his own feelings, and we won't spoil the interview and what Javi sort of finds out and tells us readers, but it's quite candid, and I hope our listeners enjoy it.
Well, with that, maybe that's a good place to get to this interview with Javier. So after the music, we'll be back with Chris's interview with Javier Martinez Brocal, the Vatican correspondent for the Spanish ABC newspaper.
Javier, welcome to the Vatican Briefing. It's so good to talk to you.
Such a pleasure, Chris.
Congratulations on this newly published book, which I think it's fair to say is the most talked about book about Pope Francis in Rome these days, which is saying a lot considering the Pope himself just had his own memoir come out. So, I mean, this is a really big deal.
Well, it has been a honor also because the main work has been done by the Pope. I mean, I've written a lot for this book, but the main words, just to say, are the Pope Francis words.
You have interviewed Pope Francis before. Could you give our listeners a sense of what it's like to enter into the Pope's home, to interview him, and how this interview was maybe different from the last time you interviewed him?
Yes, I mean, the key to understand this conversation was that Pope Francis wanted to speak about Benedict XVI. When I told him, well, why don't you write something about this, something together, I have the feeling that some people speak well on Pope Benedict just to say that you are a bad pope or that too. And he said, Benedict deserves something like this, deserves a good book about him. I want to tell how profound was our relationship. He was for me like a father. And I think that they touch a key that he wanted to speak about this. And well, speaking about with Pope Francis is very fun. He's always very human, and he has the head and the heart in heaven. Then it's very spiritual conversation. For example, he told me that there was one condition for speak with him, and it was that I cannot arrive to Casa Santa Marta with a present for him. He told me, you must arrive here with nothing in your hands, because I don't want to I want to be free of answering your questions. I want also you to be free to do your questions. And
no bribes.
No bribes. He was very respectful of what journalism is.
You know, this is a book about his relationship with his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, who died at age 95. You know, you said that the Pope wanted to collaborate with you on this book because he thought that Benedict deserved this book. Pope Benedict died at the end of 2022. In your view, why now? A bit of time has passed. Why this moment?
No, I think it was the correct moment. My proposal was only 3 weeks after Pope Benedict died. And he told me it's a very good idea, but I need time. I think he was very busy. But I also think that he wanted his ideas to
gestate a bit, of course, yes.
Yes. No, not to have this the first idea that he wanted to meditate about his relationship with Benedict. He doesn't want to answer it with rush. But sometimes when we have time. And then we did the first interview in July. Then it was 7 months after Benedict died in January. It was July. Then some time had passed. And then the Pope who could speak with a sense of history. He wanted to give his own version of the relationship. And this is the book.
The book covers some moments during the strange period in which there were two popes living inside the Vatican. You know, this was, I think, something that caught the attention of so much of the world and the imagination. There was even a movie about the two popes. But you do get into some moments to sort of revisit some of the controversies. There was one moment that talked about the ordeal where Francis sort of sets the record straight about a book that Cardinal Robert Sarah, who was then the head of the Vatican's liturgy office, had announced in 2020 that he had co-written a book with Pope Benedict XVI that dealt with questions of celibacy and the priesthood. And this was after the Amazon Synod in 2019, where this was a major issue. And some had said that the book's publication was seen as Pope Benedict trying to influence Francis on his decision on the question of married priests. What did you learn from Francis about the backstory, about how this whole incident transpired?
He was very calm. He wasn't worried. My feeling was that he was worried because a sector, some people inside the Catholic Church thought that Benedict XVI was in some way a semi-pope, someone that wanted to continue governing the church. And he said Benedict XVI didn't want to be a semi-pope. I mean, he wanted to pray, to study, to be with people, but not to get into the decisions of the daily decisions of the Pope. And he was very afraid that some people tried to enter and to force Benedict to speak out against Pope Francis. And, he doesn't say that this was some of this occasion, but when we spoke, it was in this part of the conversation. Benedict XVI didn't accept it never to speak out against Pope Francis, that some people tried to persuade him to do. And this was the situation.
Yeah, I remember when we were on the plane coming back from South Sudan in February of 23, which was about a month after Benedict's death, he said that he thought some people had instrumentalized.
Yes.
Pope Benedict's death.
Try to
instrumentalize. You know, around that time, there was also the book, the memoir of Archbishop Ganswein, Pope Benedict's longtime secretary. What did the Pope have to say about that book in your interview with him?
Well, the idea was when Pope Francis spoke with the cardinals in their last meeting on February 28th, 2013, 5 hours before leaving the papacy, he said, among you, there is the future Pope. And since this moment, I promise him my total loyalty and obedience. And Pope Francis told me, Javier, I can assure you that until the last moment, the Pope was loyal with me. Pope Benedict was always loyal with me. I think he wanted to underline this because in Georg Ganspein's book, sometimes you don't have this vision, because there are some private conversation where Benedict expressed his concern for some decisions, but they are private conversations, and the idea of presenting private conversations like Benedict XVI is criticizing Pope Francis is not what really Benedict wanted and what really Benedict did. Then I think Pope Francis wants to underline the loyalty of Benedict XVI.
Let's talk about conclaves. It's been widely reported, of course, that Cardinal Bergoglio had been the runner-up to Cardinal Ratzinger in the 25 conclave that elected Pope Benedict XVI. Francis told you he had been used by those wanting to block Ratzinger's candidacy. How so?
Yes, they didn't want to elect Cardinal Bergoglio as Pope. They, as you know, for being elected Pope, you need 2/3 and one of the votes. And at some moment, Cardinal Bergoglio got more than 1/3 of the votes. If the cardinals maintain for 2 or 3 ballots this quantity of votes, it was evident that Cardinal Ratzinger would say, well, I retire and let's find a third candidate. They didn't want Bergoglio. They wanted to stop Ratzinger. And Bergoglio said, but Ratzinger is my candidate. I mean, we know what we want. I mean, the church needs someone like Cardinal Ratzinger. I don't want to be instrumentalized in this operation.
Yeah, that's a huge revelation from him to reveal to you that Ratzinger was his candidate.
Yes.
You know, jumping ahead to 2013, what did Francis tell you about his own election and how he came to realize that he was about to become Pope?
Yes, he thought that it was like in 2005, that some people were voting him in a way of thinking, okay, let's vote Bergoglio just to understand where votes goes, and then we pass these votes to another person. He thought he was not the final candidate. He thought it was something like, okay, let's see, this is a way of thinking, but they don't want me to be Pope. And at a certain point, he realized that he was going to be a Pope. He said, it was very normal. It was not something that I realized after lunch. and I told him, what did you do when you realized that you were going to be elected Pope? And he said, oh, well, I went to sleep after lunch because I was very tired.
You know, he's able to recall all these details, you know, sometimes over 10 years ago with great clarity. And, you know, sometimes the public only sees the Pope when he's tired at the end of a long speech or a long trip. And we focus a lot on his health because he is 87 years old. But can you talk about your own sense of, you know, how he seems very involved in this interview process and seems to have a remarkable ability to remember these facts?
Yes, it was very fun. I mean, the dialogue was very fun, very, very familiar. He remembered things. I was doing questions. He said at the beginning, I want to tell you some stories and then you start with the questions. It was very normal. I brought some gelato, some ice cream.
So you violated his rule.
I violated his rule. Also, I took some cookies. I told him this is not a present, this is something just to help to speak. And it was very normal, very, very normal. I think my vision is that sometimes we speak that Pope Francis is, we say, oh, he's at the end of the pontificate. I'm not sure, because you can say this once the pontificate is finished. But what I'm very curious why so many people repeat that we are at the end of the pontificate. I mean, I have a feeling that some people want that we speak about the end of the pontificate. I'm not sure we are at the end of the pontificate. I think Pope Francis has so many surprises still, and it's going to be very fun what we are going to see in the next months.
Yes, we've got a busy year ahead. He's very ambitious. You know, just two more questions. Conclaves are known for their secrecy, and the world loves that. All eyes are trained on, you know, the roof of the Sistine Chapel to wait for the smoke, and, you know, the cardinals are in there locked inside, and part of what they do is they take vows to not reveal what happens behind those Sistine Chapel doors. Why do you think Francis, felt free to finally reveal it now that he's Pope?
I don't think that the problem or the question was the conclave, but the question was to speak about that God uses the human talents to do his will, I mean, to build the church. And he uses the good things and the bad things, and that the cardinals should do their work in their best way they can. I think the first conclave, I mean, he spoke about the first conclave just to say that he wasn't against Ratzinger as he was presented. And he spoke about the second conclave just to show the unity of the church, and in a sense that Cardinal Angelo Scola, who was his counterpart, I mean, the other cardinal who could have become pope, at a certain point said, no, I want Bergoglio, and said, I want to vote Bergoglio. I mean that, okay, they are different, but they are working for the unity of the church. And at a certain point, someone said, okay, let's vote Bergoglio. And it's not a drama.
It's quite interesting because you have in 2005, Bergoglio saying, I want Ratzinger, let's move forward. And then 2013, Scola saying, I want Bergoglio. It's an interesting parallel.
It is.
My final question to you is, you covered Pope Benedict XVI and you've covered Francis. What have you learned in the course of this book, talking to Pope Francis, revisiting the papacy of Pope Benedict, about these two popes?
Well, about Benedict, the patience. He was a very calm pope, in a sense that he was the I think one of the best, of the biggest intellectual of the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century. And he was surrounded of normal people like me. I mean, not people, normal people. And he was very patient. He was never angry or never, I mean, he was a patient pope, a calm pope, very obedient, very humble. And this is what I underline in this book. That he was a great guy, a very big man, his humanity. And about Pope Francis, I can say that he's a free man. I mean, he's always free to speak. He likes to speak like a normal person. He was taking care of my freedom and taking care of his own freedom. I think for him it's very important, the freedom to speak with who he wants about what he wants. The freedom, I think, about Pope Francis. Freedom is just an answer to the end of the pontificate of Benedict XVI, when he was just so much, people were taking care, so much taking care of him, and he was not totally free. Then Pope Francis is saying, I want to be buried where I want, I want to live where I want, I want to have the shoes of the color that they want, I mean, the freedom.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Vatican Briefing. Right now, the book is out in Spanish. It's coming out in Italian soon, and hopefully in English. And so we will obviously keep our readers posted with that. But thank you so much, my friend.
Thanks to you, Chris.
Thanks again to Javier for joining us on the Vatican Briefing this week. We're really grateful for his time and his insight and just sharing this book and his discoveries with us.
And thanks to you, Chris. That was a great interview, and it's great to record together again after a little while.
Absolutely. It was a busy few weeks leading up to Holy Week, as it always is at the Vatican. It's, for the Pope, the busiest week on his calendar in terms of the number of papal liturgies. But we have a busy few weeks ahead. The Pope is traveling a few places within Italy, and this Pope of Surprises will certainly add some more to his calendar that will give us plenty to talk about. But for now, I think that's a good place to wrap up today's episode. Thanks for joining us today on the Vatican Briefing. You can find our show notes and all of our work at the National Catholic Reporter at ncronline.org. And if you listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other service, please don't forget to click subscribe. That way you'll be notified every time we have a new episode. And until next time, you've been briefed.
The Vatican Briefing is a production of National Catholic Reporter. John Grosso is your executive producer. Joshua McAlee and Christopher White are your producers and hosts. The editing was done by Angie Von Slaughter in conjunction with David Dalt of Sandberg Media. Today's music is provided by Blue Dot Sessions. This podcast and NCR's future media initiative are made possible in part by the generosity of Bill and Jean Buchanan.